The Brexit Party won the EU elections.
All hail our new overlords. Hello, and welcome to another Previously in Europe. I'm your co-host Hugh, and I'm my lovely co-host Kieran.
Say hello, Kieran. I've been looking at so many numbers, and none of them make any sense.
Kieran's day job is like a, you're a like UX researcher or something. Like,
yes.
So it's like design and user stuff. It's not a lot of necessarily this.
It's more numbers nowadays, actually. My two worlds are slowly convening.
Okay, well then that's actually fine then. So I'm assuming you're gonna, all of your numbers will be uncontestable, correct numbers from now on. Yes, so if people had forgotten, there was an EU election. If you didn't vote, fuck you. You are in the minority for once. Yeah, so this is, we're gonna spend most of the episode doing a rough chat generally, I guess, like, mostly about like EU elections and our various takes on some of the narratives that have sprung up around it. But prior to that, Kieran is going to run through the other elections that happened of varying importance on the same day.
Yes, same day or with... Actually, yeah, no, actually, so, fuck it. They were all on the same day. So the first one would be the second round of the Lithuanian presidential election. They do have a two-round system in Lithuania. It was between Gitanas Nausėda and Ingrida Šimonytė.
Previously in Europe where we can't pronounce names.
We can't. I opened these people's Wikipedia articles for one thing and one thing only, and that was the International Phonetic Alphabet version of their names. Wasn't there. Gitanas, he won with a 66.72% of the vote. It's a bit of a slam dunk in the two-round system.
Pretty good, actually.
Yeah. He's been described as like a Russian critical person, which is apparently a factor. It's a factor in the Western European interpretation of Baltic politics, but sometimes I get the impression the Baltics don't really care too much about that, or at least not as much as Western media would like you to think they do. He's a former central banker, political independent. He's not affiliated with any party, but he's been in government before. Like, he's been the minister of competition. And they have a voter turnout requirement, but it met the requirement, so all's good. He's now the president of Lithuania in what is largely a ceremonial position.
I think, like, you know, I'm not one to enjoy like central bankers, but if you want someone in a relatively ceremonial role who's unlikely to embarrass you abroad, this is probably the ideal person in terms of being used to dealing with international dignitaries at their level.
So the thing with Ingrida was that she was largely very similar.
Right, of course.
She was a former Minister of Finance for Lithuania, largely worked as an economist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, was a deputy chairperson on the board of the Bank of Lithuania.
I'm hearing a trend that the...
she spoke more languages.
Banking system in Lithuania has a disproportional... it's a disproportional career route, apparently, to presidency.
Well, we can't guarantee you the presidency, but we can guarantee you'll get very close to it.
You're certainly in the running by having been a banker in Lithuania.
This is like at the end of the yearly report of the Bank of Lithuania. It's like, and that wraps up this quarter's earnings. And before we break for Christmas, I've just automatically entered all of you into the running for president. So... it was an opt-out system. Didn't get your emails on time.
Yeah. So I guess the takeaway is just Lithuania now has a new president and they are fine. I suppose.
Yes.
I love it when that stuff gets wrapped up neatly, which is not the result of anything else we're going to talk about.
No, it is not.
Mm.
Next thing we should talk about is the Belgian federal elections. And also, we should probably kind of point out that the regional elections happened as well during this period of time. This is often why Belgium has like the highest turnout for the EU elections, like something in the high 80s.
Yeah.
Is because like every other election is happening at the same time.
Yeah. Which I think is something that other countries have like looked into doing, but it has worked effectively very well in Belgium. They have always fixed electoral times.
Yeah.
It's like a better version of, so in the UK there's like the fixed term Parliament Act they talk about a lot, which is like a parliament is supposed to sit for 5 years, but then, you know, since that's been enacted, that's not really been the case.
No.
Like the parliament usually, someone calls an election prior to there being the scheduled one. And I do sort of like the system of, you can call snap elections, but even if you do, there's still a scheduled election.
Definitely different countries have like employed this strategy of trying to have a fixed schedule and trying to bolster EU election turnout by scheduling more things.
Yeah,
I particularly find Ireland's strategy hilarious of pairing it with another election no one cares about.
Yeah, to marginally increase turnout with the people who really care about that other thing.
Yeah, right. Belgium, like, so for anyone who doesn't know, Belgium is a federation. So the regional elections are electing the state parliaments. They also had their federal elections, which is for their larger federal parliament for the entirety of Belgium. Mm-hmm. These are both fairly important because as a federation, it's quite decentralized, the amount of control that the regions have over each other. They're almost separate countries. So what we're talking about here is the Flemish Parliament, the Wallonian Parliament, the Brussels Parliament, and the German-speaking Parliament. And then, of course, the Belgian Federal Parliament.
Yep.
Yeah. The overall takeaway that larger media kind of had was Vlaams Belang, or Balang, or however it's pronounced.
Yep.
This is the far-right Flemish interest party.
Mm-hmm.
So they only run in Flanders.
Yep.
But that also means they get into Belgian grander politics as well, because they're just sent to the Belgian parliament.
Yep.
And they were sent to the European Union parliament, but they're not in Wallonia, they're not in the German-speaking region.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not in Brussels either.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in the federal elections, we can kind of broadly say that like Ecolo Groen, which is the Green Party, gained 9 seats. Most of that. Okay. I should premise this, sorry, with a broader takeaway, which is Flanders moved right, Wallonia moved left.
Yeah. Which I think is pretty clear.
Yeah. Because even with the Greens' representation within Belgium as a whole, Ecolo Groen, who Ecolo is the like Wallonian part, Groen is the Flemish part, and they work together, especially at the federal level, they gained 9 seats. 7 of those came from Ecolo, came from the Wallonian part.
Mm-hmm.
And also, for the sake of federal elections, Brussels is considered a part of both. I don't really understand how that works, but like for anyone who doesn't know, Brussels is a traditionally French-speaking city embedded within Flanders. Like it's surrounded on all sides by Flanders.
Yeah.
The Dutch-speaking part.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other left thing that happened was the PTB, PVDA, which is the People's Workers' Party.
Yep.
Which is like Belgium's far-left party, gained 10 seats in the federal elections.
Mm-hmm.
Again, most of that coming from Brussels and Wallonia.
Yep.
But they are actually worth pointing out that they're the only party that doesn't actually have a separate party for the regions.
Yeah, they just have one big. They just have one big party.
Yeah, it might look like that because they have two names, but they just, you know, were nice enough to put it in both languages.
Yes, and that's probably, you know, that if they didn't do that, that would probably really limit their appeal in one of the areas.
And then the other thing is Vlaams Belang gained 15 seats. I think the reason why the media is going to run away with Vlaams Belang's victory is because Flanders is the more populated part of Belgium.
So their gain resulted in them being the second most, like the party with the second largest number of people voting for it.
Yes,
which is like, you know, a pretty big deal. Whereas like other parties made big gains, and especially on the left in Wallonia, but that translates to fewer people.
Yeah. And then in terms of the regional elections, what we can broadly say, like I said earlier, which is, you know, Wallonia moved left. It kind of looks like, based on the results, that there'll be a coalition formed between the traditional centre-left party, Ecolo, the Green Party, and PDP, the far-left Workers' Party of Belgium.
Yeah.
Brussels is looking very similar to Wallonia. Mm-hmm. The only difference between Brussels and Wallonia is that Greens did slightly better and PTB did slightly worse, but only compared to Wallonia. They still did quite well.
Mm.
They're still celebrating. They're like, what happened to Brussels?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's concern that in Flanders, the VB, Vlaams Belang, will be like a kingmaker for like the centre-right parties or centrist parties.
Yeah.
But the Greens, the PVDA, the far-left party, and a centrist party called Open VLD also had modest gains. The German-speaking region is kind of like a mix of the two. Modest gains for the centrist parties and the Greens. But people often forget about the German-speaking region of Belgium because it's tiny.
Yeah, yeah. And ends up being significant, realistically, in the...
They send one MEP.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Which I always find really funny, because if they seceded and became their own country, they'd get six MEPs.
Yeah, but, you know, you can't be talking about that. Something like that happening would result largely in a, well, we maybe should consider how MEPs are doled out, because that's ridiculous. Or just, yeah, they'd secede and not get into the European Union or something stupid like that. Yeah, so I guess the takeaway of this is actually very similar to the takeaway of the European election, in that, like, it is largely a mess to a certain extent, in the same, like, in the way that lots of previous Belgian elections have been. There are a few, like, big takeaways of like, if you look at Wallonia and, you know, the Green Surge, it's pretty substantial. And the PV, the Workers' Party stuff, is also quite substantial. But then, if you look at Flanders, there's, like, the ground that the far-right party gained was largely at the expense of the centrist, centre-right parties. And you're like, well, this just creates a... Belgium was already too fragmented to form governments, and now it's just exasperated the problem.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like, a lot of these cases, when the far-right, like, more nationalist party gains seats, often the centre-right response, the more conservative people in the centre-right get elevated and have to become, like, feel like they need to become more hardline, because it'll somehow convince the people who have deserted their party to come back, which doesn't work.
But,
and that's what you saw on a lot of, like, European level elections as well. And what you saw in the Spanish election, which I think now we can probably move on to Spanish local elections, which also happened, and regional elections.
Yeah, so Spain also successfully has managed to bolster turnout by lining up the majority of their regional elections and their local elections to happen at the same time as...
Yeah.
Yeah. So Spain, like we said many times in this podcast, is like a federation in all but name. It's got 17 what are called autonomicas, or autonomous regions, and 12 of the 17 regions had a regional election at the same time as the European election. Some, for like historical reasons, and the fact that like some of the Basque regions just get to decide when their elections happen. Like there's different dates for the others. So, and then also the local elections. These are quite important as well, because it's important to stress that Spain is super decentralized.
Yeah.
There's a lot of local control, which is also why you see like a lot of crazy new parties exist at a local level, or why when you closely examine most of what we would consider Spanish parties, they're actually like these coalitions of parties. Like you'll go into like one region of Spain and like, oh, there's no Podemos presence here at all. That's interesting. And then you find out, it's like, oh, that party's just a part of Podemos.
Yeah, but there's no point in Podemos trying to get seats there because they're not established and there's a local party that does what they would be saying anyway.
Yeah, there's a local party that is like already agreed to their platform, works with them at like a national level, but they just... Basically, they keep the consistent branding is kind of the thing. Which is an interesting way of doing it. I'd be interested in deep diving into that, the merits of it.
Yeah.
Okay. So the basic takeaway from this is the same on like all levels. The PSOE, the center left party, and the C's, the centrist party, or centrist in quotations, they're quite right wing. Both of those parties are up, while the traditional center right party, the PP, and the left party, Podemos, are down.
Yeah,
that's your general takeaway of pretty much all of these levels of politics, with the exception of one other additional thing, which is Vox is a thing now. So, for example, Vox got into 7 of the 12 regional parliaments. They also got quite a few local seats in local elections. In terms of other upsets, I'm going to talk about, I guess, is like Madrid was a particularly interesting region this election. Madrid kind of like bucked the trend a little bit. People in Madrid seem still quite dissatisfied with the PSOE. But they managed to hold the seats they had. PSOE has like historically done well in that region. They have like a decent stronghold, but like this nationwide rise in popularity of the PSOE did not translate in Madrid. It was just and also in Madrid, Madrid is the center ground of what cost Podemos this election, which is there has been a split in Podemos's party. This happened a while ago, but like the mayor of Madrid went and started a new party with one of the co-founders of Podemos, which for the moment, because it's only regional, is called Más Madrid, which means more Madrid.
It sounds like a party of like rabid centralization.
From that perspective, but it's actually the exact opposite. They're more in favor of municipalism, but they're running in Madrid Parliament. She's like a pretty cool mayor. This the woman that co-founded this party, but unfortunately, the split between Podemos and like this huge like establishment structure that they had within Madrid, like in the fort that now has all switched to Mass Madrid, has resulted in this like both of them doing poorly. And in the local elections, because the local elections determines like mayors, because like it basically is like localities have a parliament and the parliament decides the mayor in the same way a prime minister is kind of decided. Because of this, the left wing former Podemos, now Mass Madrid mayor of Madrid, has lost her majority. Because basically I think the overall take was the split made Podemos look very unorganized, and that lost them a lot of
Which it did.
I mean, it's kind of a weird one, actually, because this had, like, a nationwide effect, but actually it only materialized in Madrid.
In terms of...
Podemos was just as unified as it was in, like, Andalusia, Valencia, whatever. It's quite strange. Podemos was, like, kicked from a couple of parliaments. They didn't, like, get enough votes for some seats. Which is, Podemos was kicked from Cantabria and Castile and La Mancha, which are relatively yeah, relatively like left-wing strongholds, especially Castilla and La Mancha. It's like the left-behind region in Spain that turned to the left rather than the right. So, yeah, that's kind of like an interesting thing there. Other upsets in the local elections is that left-wing mayors of Zaragoza and Barcelona also lost their mayorships because of this left-wing split. The Barcelona mayor, she was really cool. Her name is Ada Colau, and she belonged to a party called Comú Barcelona, which again is one of those regional parties that actually just worked with Podemos.
Yep.
But like, yeah, they brought a lot of like, they were, for anyone who's really into like the radical municipalism movement, which is kind of like taking hold in Europe, they were like a big name of it. She brought like, returned a lot of powers to Barcelona.
Yeah.
And pumped it into like decent public services and stuff. It was really cool. And to be fair, like Mas Madrid is trying to ride that movement. One of their probably most radical things they're proposing, which is really interesting to me, is object libraries. For anyone who doesn't know, that's the idea that like there would be a library for things that are not books, but like other things that you could potentially like rent and reuse and for free.
Yeah.
For example, in Edinburgh, there was a tool library that was very useful.
Tools is often brought up as like the obvious, the really easy to explain example of it. You're like, everyone doesn't need to own like a good power drill, but at some point,
all the time,
most people do need one, but then they just need to keep it somewhere. It's a waste of time.
But they've also done some dodgy stuff that, like, I think the jury's still out on them. Basically, we'd have to see what they're like now that they exist for like more than just one election.
Yeah, this is quite unfortunate timing for the loss of like a lot of pro power devolution people in like a lot of municipalities where that is popular, because like obviously we still need to see what happens with the central government, but having Sanchez as prime minister is a lot better than like Rajoy was the, you know, famous crackdown on anyone who wants to increase devolved powers. And Sanchez's position generally has been kind of like comparatively it's a lot better, not like, you know, what Podemos and people are asking for, but it's a better opportunity, and it's a bad time to be losing power when like you actually have Sanchez, and it could potentially be a opportunity to open some of these talks and exert pressure. And if Podemos was like a combined thing with these people were using to push for more regional powers, there's potentially a Sanchez plus Podemos plus some other people coalition in the works, so that would be a good time to ask for some of these things. And if they've lost like the regional control, that would give them the ability to, you know, thumb on the scales from that end. That's actually quite bad timing.
Yeah, the it also kind of affects Sanchez to a certain extent because he currently relies on Podemos. At the nationwide level. So
But I mean, this is part of the reason why they all wanted to put off negotiations for the new central government until after the local elections. Was probably because like they wanted to use their positioning in that as part of the negotiations and to focus on it, but it hasn't super worked out for Podemos in terms of like it's kind of difficult to argue for more powers to Barcelona if we also don't have anyone in Barcelona who's willing to, you know, help us. But you know, we'll see how that pans out. It might pan out fine. Oh, we'll see. Great. So on to the glorious EU elections, the much touted second largest democratic exercise in the world. The Indian election being bigger because there are more people in India and theoretically more people vote. So things happened. There are some results, and so if you go digging around for results, numbers do differ places because people are using, so a lot of results are provisional in several countries. So there are final results for 15 countries that are like definitely final. 12 countries have provisional, and then there's like, that causes differing between where people in vote tallies are putting seats. So for instance, as an example, the Politico poll of polls thing has, it's like one of the countries they're still using exit poll data for because they don't have all of that. That might be Ireland, I'm not 100% sure.
Ireland still hasn't like declared all their seats yet, I don't think.
Yeah, so I think that they might be doing that for Ireland. Which means that, so like their numbers differ from, like, if you look at election results at EU is another example, which I believe is the, is that the official European Parliament results site? I think
that's
it is.
That's the official.
Yeah. So like they have slightly different numbers for political groupings for that reason.
The other discrepancy is that technically this election, every European country voted for their post-Brexit numbers.
Mm.
So when the UK leaves the European Parliament, the idea is that numbers will go up for certain countries, like when seats get shuffled around. For example, Ireland, the country we are from, will go from 11, what it has currently, to 13.
Uh-huh.
This means that technically that we've elected 13 MEPs, but only the top 11 will take their seats for now. Mm. So that can also be why some people might be seeing discrepancy in the results, because some country, like some places, might be showing you the post-Brexit numbers versus the versus the current situation.
That makes the Ireland one even more complicated, because again, some of the results aren't final.
Yeah,
and you're just like, so the real-time final for the what? Oh, it's goddamn.
You know, for example, if you go to the Irish Times results section, they're showing you the the post-Brexit numbers.
Yep.
Because it's already been decided which like constituencies in Ireland will get those extra seats.
Yes. So that actually like makes it makes it confusing. But like the general theme is the same. So like the EPP came first, with a mystery number of seats. I'm gonna go by the official EU election results one. So the EPP have 179 seats. That's currently by like people who are going to take their seats in the next parliament. S&D of 153. That's also down by quite a bit. ALDE plus Republican Marche and their French coalition.
Stands for Renaissance, because you have to remember their grouping is called Renaissance.
I'm not remembering that. I've decided not to. So that's them up 37. That's also bolstered quite a bit by like the Lib Dems did very well in the UK. Which we'll get onto at some point. The Greens, EFA, are up 17, with they're now on 69. ECR is down 13, and that's largely the Conservatives in the UK losing seats, and the PIS lost some seats as well. The ENF, so this is where we get into the weeds a bit, because a lot of places are doing like, calculate, so like the Politico one calculates Salvini's alliance, which is like X ENF plus Salvini plus like mystery other people who may or may not have joined it. So their number for that is 73, but if you go off the old numbers, the ENF will have 58, which is a big gain, but like it's unclear what alliance is going to be formed in like the far right slash artist previously known as Eurosceptic parties.
Yes. A big part of that is like basically there were parties that agreed to join Salvini's group, but like nothing's really final until after the election. So for example, the official European results are still marking Alternative for Deutschland as being a part of the EFDD, Nigel Farage's group, because that's where they were in the 2014 parliament. But they've, as a party, have agreed to join Salvini's group.
Yeah. So again, EFDD, they're theoretically up 13, but the EFDD can't exist now because it no longer would meet the requirement. Like, based on previous members, it would no longer meet the requirements to be a group at all, because they don't have members from enough countries. So that's Nigel Farage's theoretical group. So again, that's like the biggest bulk of these groups will not just change their name, they'll be a very different makeup. Whereas, like, for instance, ALDE are probably just going to change their name and become out there. There was earlier in the week, there was like a someone sent out a list of names they're apparently considering, and one of them was like the Europeans or European Reform. It's just like, you can't be like a European party that your name is just Europe.
Well, I thought you couldn't call yourself European Renaissance, because how the fuck are you going to be the SEO of the actual European Renaissance? But here we are.
I'm still confused if they're whether or not they're painters. The GUE NGL, so the United Left, Nordic Green Left, lost quite a bit. They're down to 38. In theory, it's losing 14. But again, it's that's also where some of the new unaffiliated parties may end up. Slash, that group might become something else. It's unclear.
A good example of that is that Ireland has elected the Independents for Change.
Yeah.
Which is like a party, quotation mark, that exists in Ireland.
Uh-huh.
Of a loose smattering of independents. They've said that they're joining the United European Left. So yeah, there's like a bunch of new parties that kind of haven't declared, or have, if they've declared, it hasn't been factored into some of these results.
Yep.
So yeah, these numbers are likely to change, and like Hugh said, especially on the right wing, these parties are likely to change.
Yes, are likely to change, and some of them will probably change name in some sense. So this ends up with like talking percentages wise, where is the so basically this is kind of, you're now in a situation where this isn't that dissimilar to the situation you were in the last parliament.
Mm-hmm.
But people have kind of like, you know, learned from the negotiations which formed the last parliament. So like what you need to do now is start working at coalitions to get a majority in the parliament, but kind of before then, the countries need to get together, slash the parliament needs to get together and decide on head of the European Council and head of the European Commission, and then all the commissioners. And effectively, while majority in the parliament can kind of truck on for a while, and you can just elect a president of the parliament at some point in the future, because the parliament just elects the president. Mm. Whereas the commission's, the current, like the Juncker Commission's mandate will end, and then most countries have kind of said that, well, we expect to have someone sorted to be the head of it, and then all the commissioners named in like early in the summer.
Mm.
So ideally like in during this month. But the makeup of this parliament kind of means that even more so than the Belgian parliament, this is very like, there's, you would need at least three parties to form any coalition, and that like that can basically either be the EPP, S&D plus ALDE, or EPP, S&D plus Greens, or you come up with something more complicated.
Mm.
And I guess the like one takeaway of that is, why would ALDE agree to that unless they got something very good in return? And same with the Greens. Why would the Greens agree to that unless they got something very good out of it? And there is like the argument to be made that the Greens will probably ask for more like policy stuff rather than asking for like a powerful position in either the council or the commission. But like, since ALDE will now be ALDE plus Macron, and Macron has, most of Macron's policies are, I want to do these big European changes and plans. It seems to me that ALDE will basically demand the head of something, which, I mean, so the status quo from the last parliament was the EPP kind of over time ended up with all of the heads of everything, despite them only being half the coalition.
Yeah.
Which is, so for people who don't remember, so Donald Tusk is a member of the EPP, and he's head of the European Commission, as is Jean-Claude Juncker, who's head of, or sorry, head of the council, and Juncker is head of the commission, who's also in the EPP, and then originally Schulz was head of the parliament, but then
he left for German politics.
Yeah, he left for German politics, and Tajani replaced him, who's an EPP member. So from the get-go, they already had two out of three of the head jobs, and then they ended up with all three of them by the end of it, which, I mean, isn't great, and like they lost a lot of seats. In fact, they lost the most seats of anybody.
And they did.
While they still came first, they're coming first with like under 25% of the vote. So like, they can't expect to get more than one job, one of the top jobs, reasonably. And a lot of people do not like their candidate for their Spitzenkandidat person, Manfred Weber.
Manfred Weber.
There's that seems to be the difference that's striking me this time, is that the whole who gets what job thing and coalition forming is a bit more catty.
Than
it was last time
as well.
Yeah. So like both the Greens and I would say ALDE Renaissance are like actually pitching themselves more in a kingmaker position.
They
might even be looking at the idea of taking they look like they're taking a leaf out of the book of like Finnish politics. Where they're kind of pitching the idea of like, we'll be the kingmaker and you guys can get a lot of these like positions within all these other things, but we're getting the commission president. As the kingmaker.
Exactly. I think that's like that's not actually even an unrealistic plan.
No.
I guess so. Now we could look at this in terms of what's your best case scenario prediction / goal, and then explain if that's realistic or not.
All right, so for me, in terms of like coalition building, so an interesting one that was posited by Timmermans, the Spitzenkandidat for SND, is that he's kind of like positing this like keep Manfred Weber out coalition, which is four parties that are the Liberals, ALDE, Greens, SND, Timmermans group, presumably, although it's not stated in the quote, but presumably. I don't think he's advocating for a coalition that doesn't involve his party. That'd be weird. And also the far left, United European Left, Nordic Green Left.
Yep.
And that would be like an interesting coalition.
Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of like actual like commission president candidate, I think the person I can probably like hope for the best would be Bas Eickhout. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yep.
He is one of the co-leaders of the Greens EFA and one of the co-like Spitzenkandidats.
Yep.
And he's from Groen Links in the Netherlands, which is, from a lot of people's perspective in the Netherlands, is like the furthest left you can vote, like while actually achieving anything or not being xenophobic. So like, I think that would be the best. Like, the other candidate is Ska Keller, which comes from the German Greens, which is not as left-wing as I would like them to be as a Green party. So, like, that's, like, the ideal situation, I think, that is, like, remotely practical.
Yeah.
But how practical that actually is...
I think core problem of that is that that's not a majority.
Yes, that coalition does not make a majority unless, like, a bunch of these undeclared parties join one of those four groups.
Or if the Five Star joined it. if they remain not in a grouping and for some reason decided to prop up the like technically not establishment, because most of the people involved won't have been in the previous operating thing. Basically, there's no... Yeah, it's interesting. It's, the EPP is... not done well compared to their previous standing and their like presumed positioning themselves as like the default runners of Europe. But like it is very difficult to make a coalition without them because of the share of like ambiguous / very far right parties. And Manfred Weber continued to try and sell himself as we need to not work with the far right, but like people need to remember that Manfred Weber is from the CSU, the like hyper conservative Bavarian sister party to the CDU in Germany, where like they're very much seen as pulling the CDU to the right, especially on immigration.
It's worth pointing out that like before AfD came on the scene in German politics, like which was relatively recent, that was the furthest right you could vote for.
Was
his party.
Yeah. And it was like a constant thing of the like effectively what Merkel was doing, like along with a lot of like, you know, questionable policy, but like on an international stage, Merkel's like pro-European face, and kind of compared to a lot of the like a lot of the stakeholders in Europe, was like very was a lot better on immigration than most, like most of the countries east of her. Was like, you know, the CSU's response to that was like, Merkel is betraying our values on a national stage. It's like, yeah, if you don't like Merkel because she's conservative, you haven't seen the CSU, and like one of their members becoming commission president would be like, would be outrageous, and it would be largely validating the position of a lot of the far right parties, where they're like, if we keep advocating for this, all the other parties will have to come towards us. Which is a lot of their stated goals, and it would then just be true.
I think
sorry, you go on.
I'm just kind of looking at previous numbers, and it's like, this is the second EU election where the EPP is the like biggest loser in terms of raw numbers. They lost the most seats. Now, it might be fair to say that like, before that they had the most seats, but you know, it's still a figure. Like, it's not like, in general, I think one of the other takeaways that I think is relatively true that I saw in a lot of the media is that like, you can see this election as a failure of center parties, and like broad center of like center left, center right.
Yep.
Yeah. Because even though the it's a really odd one, because in terms of raw numbers, like the far left didn't do that well. It depends who you ask whether you consider the Greens to be far left, but even then, their like numbers aren't like staggering. They did well for green parties.
Yeah. So like, if you combine the net of the, you know, Nordic Green Left plus actual Greens, then you're talking about a gain of like 3-ish seats, depending on like which numbers you look at. And you're like, well, that's not good. That's not good at all. That's like actively bad. Whereas, you know, the if you just look at the party that were previously in what we would consider like far right groupings, like they both made big gains that were more substantial than that. And that's with no caveats, realistically. Because like the ambiguous parties in like the EFDD, they lost seats, whereas the far right parties in it gained seats, or became a new party, the Nigel Farage vanity project.
Yeah. I think the thing, though, is that the story is kind of the same in every country, which is, well, maybe this isn't reflecting in the results. The general mood on the ground is like, we aren't happy with the center parties. And the punishment for that is manifesting in different ways.
Yep.
That kind of comes out as a big like mess of brown when you mix all the colors together, whatever metaphor I'm going for here, at the European level. But like, that does seem to be the story the whole way over. Because, like, to give an example of, like, Germany, where the Greens did quite well, they've overtaken, like, they're the second largest party in Germany in terms of, like, raw seats.
Yep.
It's not that, like, Germany suddenly became more environmentalist.
No, yeah.
It is because the SPD has collapsed, effectively. Like, the Green wave isn't, some people are positing, it's like, you know, things like Greta Thunberg and things like that, which, and Fridays for Future, which are their movements I support and whatnot. But at the same time, it's not like, that isn't the motivating factor, I don't think. It is people actually just looking for an alternative.
Yeah, I think in some, like in some countries, it is part of it. It's kind of like, okay, we need to look for an alternative. But in, so like, why didn't some of the other, why didn't some of the parties that were kind of more centery get S&D votes, like the newer parties? Or like, why didn't like DiEM25 and like, I don't know, why didn't Volt get more seats? Is like part of my point, that like the Greens are kind of like a position of, well, if you don't like the center party, we're gonna do something similar but with a more environmental stint on it. So like, I guess there's the question of why would people go to them versus someone else, and that is definitely, I think that's part of it. But the green wave isn't necessarily just about environmentalism. It's more, it is like, as you say, about like, I think it's probably a combination of, cool, we're leaving these center parties because they're not doing what they're not actually like standing for anything in particular other than the status quo, which we've decided isn't good. and Where Do We Go? I guess this Green Party is like Other Things I Like, and they might have been my second choice anyway, partially for environmental reasons. Like, a lot of Green Parties around Europe, like once you drill, like you've alluded to it, that once you drill down into the German Green Party, they have a lot of like not actually great on some like points of their environmental plan aspects. And I think you have a similar thing in a lot of countries. So like you have a problem in the UK where a lot of Green candidates aren't like super well thought out candidates necessarily, because they exist in places where it's a first past the post system and they never had a chance of getting in anyway. So the local party isn't necessarily putting forward someone who you'd be like, oh, they'd probably be real good at being an MEP or being a thing, or they have some like weird side opinion on like, you know, GMO or something else related, like something of that nature. So they're not necessarily ideal. Oh, if I'm not going to vote for like the Labour Party, I'm my next obvious choice is a Green Party. If you're not factoring in some level of environmentalism or like awareness.
I think there's also a little bit of just kind of going back to your point about like why not vote for these other parties. I think there's also a little bit of like tactical voting aspect to it, of like I'm voting for these parties because I also realistically think they'll get seats. They're not the center parties, they're not the establishment parties that I have always voted for, or you know, were like the big ones on the table. They're not the CDUs, SPDs of the world, but they will get seats. Is like, I think that's what differentiates them from maybe some other parties.
Yep.
Especially when some of the ones you listed, like DiEM25 and Volt. But like,
Kieran's favorite, Volt.
My favorite. I think that's an aspect as well. I think the other side is that like a lot of these parties will pitch themselves, like regardless of like how right wing I think the Green Party in Germany, like I think it is, and like that's getting down into some weeds and like how they've acted in like state government. Versus like what they kind of claim on a national level. Like it is, there is a successful branding of these kind of parties, that the Greens are traditionally further to the left than the center left. So it's possible that people think that's the space they're entering into without really going into it further.
Yeah, I think from a broad strokes perspective, that's probably true.
Yeah.
That reasonable. I think there's like a few narratives around the election that I find I think like the broad strokes are generally true. There's like ALDE's a lot more strong, which is, you know, the case, but it's like they don't offset the losses of the other, like the center parties.
Yeah, and they were a mixed bag as well. Countries that like they've historically done well in, they didn't do well in.
Yes. They're like, has been a green wave to an extent in that the Green Party's gained a lot of seats, but it's like if you compare it to the quote unquote like far right wave, it's like a lot smaller in terms of but like that's the, I think the, like a lot of the analysis of this is like a lot of these, so a large chunk of ALDE's increase in performance is that it's now ALDE plus En Marche numbers. So then you're factoring in, well, did ALDE overall have a giant like surge? Like sort of, but not really. Like they had a modest gain if you don't consider that. And similar with like Salvini's thing is, well, once you factor in La Liga, that's a big chunk of that increase. So a lot of these like big changes are more localized than you think they would be. Whereas like the EPP and S&D losing seats is kind of broadly across most of the continent.
Yeah.
So how do you feel about the election?
Overall, it's more just kind of like something that happened. The results are really a bit of a mixed bag. I guess like my main concerns is my main concerns would be like the consolidation of the far right.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a reasonable concern, because the picture is quite muddied with the current, like, because they don't have their grouping sorted out. So the grouping could be in a range of numbers, and that number could be quite high, but it's unclear yet.
Yeah, because like there are like alliances within this group. There are alliances that are quite strong, such as like Le Pen's and Salvini's kind of alliance is quite strong. They're going to work quite well together. And they are really trying to approach Brexit Party, which Brexit Party were like joint first for national parties in terms of seats.
Mm-hmm.
They got 29 seats, and that's joint first with the CDU in Germany that also got 29 seats.
Yeah, right.
So that combined with like a bunch of other reshuffling that might happen due to the collapse of the EFDD, like if they can pull Farage away, the rest of the group just kind of like falls apart, and then that's pretty much the only place they have to turn.
Yep.
Unless some of them go to ECR. Yep. Some of the parties that they were relying on to do well didn't do well. Danish People's Party is a good example of that. But they still got a seat, so that's still like that helps with the numbers. So there's things like that have me worried. Certain narratives also have me worried. I think one thing that has me concerned is like I'm starting to see the narrative like poo-pooing the kind of idea of left populism. Like because the results of say of Podemos, La France Insoumise were not stellar. And that's kind of like two of the big faces of these kind of movements. So basically, you can summarize this entire movement of what usually called left populism as the new European grouping called Now the People, which is Left Bloc from Portugal, La France Insoumise from France, Podemos from Spain, and you couple that with the like left wing parties of the three Nordic EU countries, so Denmark, Finland, and Sweden. And they are like, they are still a part of like GUE, NGL, but they've kind of, the thing that kind of unites them is that they've kind of looked at what Corbyn did in the UK.
Yeah.
And found that was a better way to organize, get messages across, and like push policies and agendas. And I genuinely agree with those parties that that is a good way to do it. And I think there's going to be this like blanket statement that like, oh, this doesn't work now. And they're probably going to mix that in with like Labour's poor performance in the UK. But like really when you get down to it, these are all kind of like national issues, because all the Nordic, these Nordic left parties did quite well.
Yeah.
But like none of the Nordic countries are huge heavy hitters in terms of seats.
No, certainly not. Yeah.
But like Podemos had like an internal schism that caused problems. The Left Bloc didn't like increase the number of seats, but they didn't fall either, and they're still quite popular within Portugal. I actually don't know what happened with La France Insoumise, and my understanding of what happened with Labour in the UK is they just didn't organise for this election.
So they did organise for the election, but it's a two-pronged problem of like the turnout was basically nothing. It was like
37%,
which is ridiculously low.
Yeah,
and then on top of that, the like, there is a lot of truth to like the annoyance a lot of Labour's traditional voters or people who'd be like, oh, I only ever voted Labour, saying, but they have this weird ambiguous Brexit thing going on where there's always caveats to everything that comes out of the central people, and you have then people who are in the shadow cabinet who make like statements that are then contradicted the following day by their leader. So you're kind of like, well, we actually don't know where you stand, no matter how much like campaign material you send out, because you are trying to organize, but you're sending a weird, like, complicated, unclear message. And people are kind of the people who bothered to turn out generally turned out on a like, well, how does this relate to Brexit? Like, I tried talking to a lot of people who I know and kind of like but if you look at how it relates to like the temporary makeup of the European Parliament and have it my factor in the commission, they were just like, yeah, but we don't care because it's not going to affect us soon. I was like, that's reasonable. And yeah, I think the winds definitely weren't in their favor in terms of, it's the thing, like, there's the vast majority of narratives around like various popularities and then lack of popularities of Corbyn in particular. Like, some of that is bigged up by, like, stuff that has been semi-fabricated by various people in media, like, large media control and other parties. But, like, the ambiguous Brexit policy thing is kind of true, upsettingly. And it is annoying people a lot more than they like to think it is.
Yeah, I think like they've learned from that now because they're saying they're backing a second referendum.
Yeah, no, but this is, I think this is the best example of this. The following day, Corbyn gave a statement where he said, "Oh, but like a second referendum would be quite far off, and I won't say yes or no as to whether like remaining in the European Union would be on such a referendum." And I was like, "Cool, so you said like a day or two ago, you said, okay, well, we definitely like." We're definitely backing a second referendum, but then 2 days later you're like, but we didn't say what kind of referendum. It's like,
right, okay,
this is what people are annoyed about, is they say something that sounds clear and then subsequently someone at some point later on down the line says, oh, and obviously this is our policy, and everyone's like, that's not what anyone thought your policy was. That's not, like, you think you're being clear but you're actively being unclear. Which is classically why Centrist parties lost seats, I think, in most countries, is because they say things and then later they're doing like the caricature of a politician thing where they say, well, this has always been our policy, we're always going to do this. Like, well, this is, people fucking hate about.
So those are kind of my feelings on the European election, which is kind of, I don't want to say positive, but they're not negative either, I guess.
I'm just largely very, very happy that the turnout was above 50% across the continent, which I think is, like, that's a more than an 8% increase, which for several successive elections in a row, it's always been dropping slowly.
Yeah.
A lot of people's predictions was that it was going to be even lower this time, but it wasn't. So that's good.
That is good. That was a 20% increase in Germany.
Yeah. So there's a couple of countries that had, like, big swings up, and obviously there was countries that didn't, and like actually the UK is dragging down that percentage quite substantially. So I think once if and when Brexit actually happens and they leave the parliament, which if they don't leave the parliament, that's very funny for all the people who got elected technically as future MEPs once they leave, but they don't leave. Screw them for coming nearly in. But yeah, that'll increase the turnout as well, which I think is good. Yeah, my general takeaway from it is that, like, I think the most likely thing to happen, but the worst thing to happen, would be the EPP, S&D, and ALDE form a mega coalition that has a comfortable majority, but is kind of, it's kind of cementing what a lot of people say. Is a problem with the EU that it's just run by this like glob of centrist people, which is kind of just what ended up happening. And ALDE won't have enough power to get a lot of the good parts of their reforms through, but the things that they agree on the EPP with, for instance, will start happening, which is a lot of which is bad. and it just means there's like a more contained majority for like the bad things the EU have been doing lately, like their bullshit copyright reform and stuff like that. And it might not end up with ALDE getting any of the, like, good voices in ALDE in any power. It's certainly not going to get, like, Guy Verhofstadt commission president or anything. So I'm not worried about that. But I think it's unlikely that, like, Timmermans or someone becomes commission president, or someone with, like, a centre-left-ish lean. My prediction is that, like, Vestager, the competition commissioner, is like not unlikely to be brought in as president as a consensus person, or she might get head of something like council president or something maybe. I think that's the most likely thing to happen, is a mega coalition that just takes a long time to work out the, you know,
nitty gritty of.
Yeah, which is fine.
Yeah, it's, I'm a little upset by the point that like if Vestager basically gets taken out of her competition role.
Yeah.
Cause she's doing something good there, and guaranteeably the person who comes in next is just probably just not going to have the teeth that she had.
No. But largely, I just want anyone but Manfred Weber as a president. Yes, that's really... I'll take a lot of people over Manfred Weber.
It's the reasonable center position.
Yeah. Anyone but Weber. I think that's our endorsement.
Previously in Europe is recorded by and produced by Hugh O'Brien and Kieran Dold. If you like the show, tell a friend about it. That stuff really helps. And also, you can leave us a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, as it's called now. I keep forgetting that. I think also Spotify has a review function. You should do that. And the biggest way you can help the podcast is donating to the Patreon, which helps us keep the podcasting lights on, because I'm afraid of the dark. I'm afraid of the podcast dark. And the cool cats who support us on Patreon will get their names read out. These cool cats include Dermot Burke, Dries Arian, Justin Paul Sammons, Lisa Shalagina, Niall McLaughlin. Yes, those are those cool kids. And there are other cool kids, but these are the cool kids who get their name read out. And you can also do other things on the Patreon, like get access to an early bonus episode that comes out once a month, or get to use the suggestion box. The suggestion box is where you type things on Patreon and we kind of have to respond to them. Also, in terms of social media, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and on email. Our email is previouslyineurope@gmail.com. We are at PrevInEurope, P-R-E-V in Europe on Twitter. And if you want to find us on Facebook, we have a Facebook group. You just search Previously in Europe. And I believe that's everything. There is a website where all this is kept. For further information, go to previouslyineurope.eu. There you can find all the links that I just mentioned. Thank you for listening.